This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Freakonomics, a rogue economist explores the hidden side of everything, the revised edition, by Stephen D. Levitt and Stephen J. Dubner, read by Stephen J. Dubner. Copyright 2005 by Stephen D. Levitt and Stephen J. Dubner. Revised material copyright 2006 by Stephen D. Levitt and Stephen J. Dubner. Production copyright 2005-2006, HarperCollins Publishers.
An explanatory note. The most brilliant young economist in America, the one so deemed at least by a jury of his elders, brakes to a stop at a traffic light on Chicago's south side. It is a sunny day in mid-June. He drives an aging green Chevy Cavalier with a dusty dashboard and a window that doesn't quite shut, producing a dull roar at highway speeds. But the car is quiet for now, as are the noontime streets, gas stations, boundless concrete, brick buildings with plywood windows. An elderly homeless man approaches. It says he is homeless right on his sign, which also asks for money. He wears a torn jacket, too heavy for the warm day, and a grimy red baseball cap. The economist doesn't lock his doors or inch the car forward, nor does he go scrounging for spare change. He just watches, as if through one-way glass. After a while, the homeless man moves along. "He had nice headphones," says the economist, still watching in the rearview mirror. "Well, nicer than the ones I have. Otherwise, it doesn't look like he has many assets." Stephen Levitt tends to see things differently than the average person. Differently, too, than the average economist. This is either a wonderful trait or a troubling one, depending on how you feel about economists. The New York Times Magazine, August 3, 2003. In the summer of 2003, the New York Times Magazine sent Stephen J. Dubner, an author and journalist, to write a profile of Stephen D. Levitt, a heralded young economist at the University of Chicago. Dubner, who was researching a book about the psychology of money, had lately been interviewing many economists and found that they often spoke English as if it were a fourth or fifth language. Levitt, who had just won the John Bates Clark Medal, awarded every 2 years to the best American economist under 40, had lately been interviewed by many journalists and found that their thinking wasn't very, well, robust, as an economist might say. But Levitt decided that Dubner wasn't a complete idiot, and Dubner found that Levitt wasn't a human slide rule. The writer was dazzled by the inventiveness of the economist's work and his knack for explaining it. Despite Levitt's elite credentials, Harvard undergrad, a PhD from MIT, a stack of awards, he approached economics in a notably unorthodox way. He seemed to look at things not so much as an academic, but as a very smart and curious explorer, a documentary filmmaker perhaps, or a forensic investigator, or a bookie whose markets ranged from sports to crime to pop culture. Levitt professed little interest in the sort of monetary issues that come to mind when most people think about economics. He practically blustered with self-effacement. "I just don't know very much about the field of economics," he told Dubner at one point, swiping the hair from his eyes. "I'm not good at math. I don't know a lot of econometrics, and I also don't know how to do theory. If you ask me about whether the stock market's going to go up or down, if you ask me whether the economy is going to grow or shrink, if you ask me whether deflation is good or bad, if you ask me about taxes, I mean, it would be total fakery if I said I knew anything about any of those things." What interested Levitt were the stuff and riddles of everyday life. His investigations were a feast for anyone wanting to know how the world really works. His singular attitude was evoked in Dubner's resulting article. As Levitt sees it, economics is a science with excellent tools for gaining answers, but a serious shortage of interesting questions. His particular gift is the ability to ask such questions. For instance, if drug dealers make so much money, why do they still live with their moms? Which is more dangerous, a gun or a swimming pool? What really caused crime rates to plunge during the past decade? Do real estate agents have their clients' best interest at heart? Why do black parents give their children names that may hurt their career prospects? Do Do school teachers cheat to meet high-stakes testing standards? Is sumo wrestling corrupt? And how does a homeless man in tattered clothing afford $50 headphones? Many people, including a fair number of his peers, might not recognize Levitt's work as economics at all. But he has merely distilled the so-called dismal science to its most primal aim, explaining how people get what they want. Unlike most academics, he is unafraid of using personal observations and curiosities. He is also unafraid of anecdote and storytelling, but he is afraid of calculus. He is an intuitionist. He sifts through a pile of data to find a story that no one else has found. He figures a way to measure an effect that veteran economists had declared unmeasurable. His abiding interests, though he says he has never trafficked in them himself, are cheating, corruption, and crime. The New York Times Magazine, August 3, 2003. Levitt's blazing curiosity also proved attractive to thousands of New York Times readers. He was beset by questions and queries, riddles and requests, from General Motors and the New York Yankees and U.S. senators, but also from prisoners and parents and a man who for 20 years had kept precise data on the sale of bagels. A former Tour de France champion called Levitt to ask his help in proving that the current tour is rife with doping. The Central Intelligence Agency wanted to know how Levitt might use data to catch money launderers and terrorists. What they were all responding to was the force of Levitt's underlying belief that the modern world, despite a surplus of obfuscation, complication, and downright deceit, is not impenetrable, is not unknowable, and, if the right questions are asked, is even more intriguing than we think. All it takes is a new way of looking. In New York City, the publishers were telling Levitt he should write a book. "Write a book," he said? "I don't want to write a book." He already had a million more riddles to solve than time to solve them. Nor did he think of himself as much of a writer. So he said that no, he wasn't interested. Unless, he proposed, maybe Dubner and I could do it together. Collaboration isn't for everyone. But the two of them, henceforth known as the two of us, decided to talk things over to see if such a book might work. We decided it could. We hope you agree. Preface to the revised and expanded edition. As we were writing Freakonomics, we had grave doubts that anyone would actually read it, and we certainly never envisioned the need for this revised and expanded edition, but we are happy and grateful to have been proven wrong. So why bother with a revised edition? There are a few reasons. The first is that the world is a living, breathing, changing thing, whereas a book is not. Once an author finishes a manuscript, it is forced to sit dead in the water for nearly a year until it is made ready by its publisher for its debut. This doesn't pose much of a problem if you have written, say, a history of the Third Punic War, but because Freakonomics explores all sorts of modern, real-world issues, and because the modern world tends to change quite fast, we've gone through the book and made a number of minor updates. Also, we made some mistakes. It was usually a reader who would bring a mistake to our attention, and we very much appreciate this input. Again, most of these changes are quite minor. The most aggressively revised section of this book is the beginning of Chapter 2, which tells a story of one man's crusade against the Ku Klux Klan. Several months after Freakonomics was first published, it was brought to our attention that this man's portrayal of his crusade and of various other Klan matters was considerably overstated. For a fuller explanation, you can listen to the essay called Hoodwinked toward the end of this recording. As unpleasant as it was to acknowledge this error and to diminish the reputation of a man beloved in many quarters, we felt it was important to set straight the historical record. We have also futzed a bit with the architecture of the book. In the original version, each chapter was preceded by an excerpt of the New York Times Magazine profile that one of us, Dubner, that's me, wrote about the other, Levitt, and which led to this book being written in the first place. Because some readers found these excerpts intrusive, and or egomaniacal, and or sycophantic, we've removed them. instead reproducing the complete Times article toward the end of this recording in a section labeled Bonus Material. There, it can be easily skipped over if one so chooses, or read in isolation. The further bonus material is what accounts for our having called this edition expanded in addition to revised. Soon after the original publication of Freakonomics in April 2005, we began writing a monthly column for the New York Times Magazine. We have included in this edition several of these columns on subjects ranging from voting behavior to dog poop to the economics of sexual preference. In the revised print edition of Freakonomics, we also included a variety of writings from our blog, www.freakonomics.com/blog/, which, like this revised edition, was not planned. In the beginning, we built a website merely to perform archival and trafficking functions. We blogged reluctantly, tentatively, infrequently. But as the months went on, and as we discovered an audience of people who had read Freakonomics and were eager to bat its ideas back and forth, we took to it more enthusiastically. A blog, as it turns out, is an author's perfect antidote for that sickening feeling of being dead in the water once a manuscript has been completed. Particularly for a book like this one, a book of ideas, there is nothing more intoxicating than to be able to extend those ideas, to continue to refine and challenge and wrestle with them, even as the world marches on. Introduction: The Hidden Side of Everything. Anyone living in the United States in the early 1990s and paying even a whisper of attention to the nightly news or a daily paper could be forgiven for having been scared out of his skin. The culprit was crime. It had been rising relentlessly. A graph plotting the crime rate in any American city over recent decades looked like a ski slope in profile. And it seemed now to herald the end of the world as we knew it. Death by gunfire, intentional and otherwise, had become commonplace. So too had carjacking, crack dealing, robbery and rape. Violent crime was a gruesome, constant companion, and things were about to get even worse, much worse. All the experts were saying so. The cause was the so-called super predator. For a time, he was everywhere, glowering from the cover of newsweeklies, swaggering his way through foot-thick government reports. He was a scrawny, big-city teenager with a cheap gun in his hand and nothing in his heart but ruthlessness. There were thousands out there just like him, we were told, a generation of killers about to hurl the country into deepest chaos. In 1995, the criminologist James Allen Fox wrote a report for the U.S. Attorney General that grimly detailed the coming spike in murders by teenagers. Fox proposed optimistic and pessimistic scenarios. In the optimistic scenario, he believed, the rate of teen homicides would rise another 15% over the next decade. In the pessimistic scenario, it would more than double. The next crime wave will get so bad, he said, that it will make 1995 look like the good old days. Other criminologists, political scientists, and similarly learned forecasters laid out the same horrible future, as did President Clinton. We know we've got about 6 years to turn this juvenile crime thing around, Clinton said, or our country is going to be living with chaos, and my successors will not be giving speeches about the wonderful opportunities of the global economy. They'll be trying to keep body and soul together for people on the streets of these cities. The smart money was plainly on the criminals. And then, instead of going up and up, crime began to fall, and fall and fall and fall some more. The crime drop was startling in several respects. It was ubiquitous, with every category of crime falling in every part of the country. It was persistent, with incremental decreases year after year. And it was entirely unanticipated, especially by the very experts who had been predicting the opposite. The magnitude of the reversal was astounding. The teenage murder rate, instead of rising 100% or even 15%, as James Allen Fox had warned, fell more than 50% within 5 years. By the year 2000, the overall murder rate in the United States had dropped to its lowest level in 35 years. So had the rate of just about every other sort of crime, from assault to car theft. Even though the experts had failed to anticipate the crime drop, which was in fact well underway even as they made their horrifying predictions, they now hurried to explain it. Most of their theories sounded perfectly logical. It was the roaring 1990s economy, they said, that helped turn back crime. It was the proliferation of gun control laws, they said. It was the sort of innovative policing strategies put into place in New York City, where murders fell from 2,245 in 1990 to 596 in 2003. These theories were not only logical, they were also encouraging, for they attributed the crime drop to specific and recent human initiatives. If it was gun control and clever police strategies and better-paying jobs that quelled crime, well then, the power to stop criminals had been within our reach all along, as it would be the next time, God forbid, that crime got so bad. These theories made their way, seemingly without question, from the experts' mouths to the journalists' ears to the public's mind. In short, they became conventional wisdom. There was only one problem. They weren't true. There was another factor, meanwhile, that had greatly contributed to the massive crime drop of the 1990s. It had taken shape more than 20 years earlier and concerned a young woman in Dallas named Norma McCorvey. Like the proverbial butterfly that flaps its wings on one continent and eventually causes a hurricane on another, Norma McCorvey dramatically altered the course of events without intending to. All she had wanted was an abortion. She was a poor, uneducated, unskilled, alcoholic, drug-using 21-year-old woman who had already given up two children for adoption and now, in 1970, found herself pregnant again. But in Texas, as in all but a few states at that time, abortion was illegal. As it happened, McCorvey's cause was adopted by people far more powerful than she. They made her the lead plaintiff in a class-action lawsuit seeking to legalize abortion. The defendant was Henry Wade, the Dallas County District Attorney. The case ultimately made it to the U.S. Supreme Court, by which time McCorvey's name had been disguised as Jane Roe. On January 22, 1973, the court ruled in favor of Ms. Roe, allowing legalized abortion throughout the country. By this time, of course, it was far too late for Ms. McCorvey Roe to have her abortion. She had given birth and put the child up for adoption. Years later, she would renounce her allegiance to legalized abortion and become a pro-life activist. So how did Roe v. Wade help trigger, a generation later, the greatest crime drop in recorded history? As far as crime is concerned, it turns out that not all children are born equal, not even close. Decades of studies have shown that a child born into an adverse family environment is far more likely than other children to become a criminal. And the millions of women most likely to have an abortion in the wake of Roe v. Wade, poor, unmarried, and teenage mothers for whom illegal abortions had been too risky and too expensive, were often models of adversity. They were the very women whose children, if born, would have been much more likely than average to become criminals. But because of Roe v. Wade, these children weren't being born. This powerful cause would have a drastic, distant effect. Years later, just as these unborn children would have entered their criminal primes, the rate of crime began to plummet. It wasn't gun control, or a strong economy, or new police strategies that finally blunted the American crime wave. It was, among other factors, the reality that the pool of potential criminals had dramatically shrunk. Now, as the crime drop experts, the former crime doomsayers, spun their theories to the media, how many times did they cite legalized abortion as a cause? Zero. It is the quintessential blend of commerce and camaraderie. You hire a real estate agent to sell your home. She sizes up its charms, snaps some pictures, sets the price, writes a seductive ad, shows the house aggressively, negotiates the offers, and sees the deal through to its end. Sure, it's a lot of work, but she's getting a nice cut. On the sale of a $300,000 house, a typical 6% agent fee yields $18,000. $18,000, you say to yourself, that's a lot of money. But you also tell yourself that you never could have sold the house for $300,000 on your own. The agent knew how to, what's that phrase she used, maximize the house's value. She got you top dollar, right? Right? A real estate agent is a different breed of expert than a criminologist, but she is every bit the expert. That is, she knows her field far better than the layman on whose behalf she is acting. She is better informed about the house's value, the state of the housing market, even the buyer's frame of mind. You depend on her for this information. That, in fact, is why you hired an expert. As the world has grown more specialized, countless such experts have made themselves similarly indispensable. Doctors, lawyers, contractors, stockbrokers, auto mechanics, mortgage brokers, financial planners, they all enjoy a gigantic informational advantage. And they use that advantage to help you, the person who hired them, get exactly what you want for the best price. Right? It would be lovely to think so, but experts are human, and humans respond to incentives. How any given expert treats you, therefore, will depend on how that expert's incentives are set up. Sometimes his incentives may work in your favor. For instance, a study of California auto mechanics found that they often passed up a small repair bill by letting failing cars pass emissions inspections, the reason being that lenient inspections are rewarded with repeat business. But in a different case, an expert's incentives may work against you. In a medical study, it turned out that obstetricians in areas with declining birth rates are much more likely to perform C-section deliveries than obstetricians in growing areas, suggesting that when business is tough, doctors try to ring up more expensive procedures. It is one thing to muse about experts abusing their position and another to prove it. The best way to do so would be to measure how an expert treats you versus how he performs the same service for himself. Unfortunately, a surgeon doesn't operate on himself. Nor is his medical file a matter of public record. Neither is an auto mechanic's repair log for his own car. Real estate sales, however, are a matter of public record. And real estate agents often do sell their own homes. A recent set of data covering the sale of nearly 100,000 houses in suburban Chicago shows that more than 3,000 of those houses were owned by the agents themselves. Before plunging into the data, it helps to ask a question. What is the real estate agent's incentive when she is selling her own home? Simple. To make the best deal possible. Presumably, this is also your incentive when you are selling your home. And so, your incentive and the real estate agent's incentive would seem to be nicely aligned. Her commission, after all, is based on the sale price. But as incentives go, commissions are tricky. First of all, a 6% real estate commission is typically split between the seller's agent and the buyers. Each agent then kicks back half of her take to the agency, which means that only 1.5% of the purchase price goes directly into your agent's pocket. So on the sale of your $300,000 house, her personal take of the $18,000 commission is $4,500. Still not bad, you say. But what if the house was actually worth more than $300,000? What if, with a little more effort and patience and a few more newspaper ads, she could have sold it for $310,000. After the commission, that puts an additional $9,400 in your pocket. But the agent's additional share, her personal 1.5% of the extra $10,000, is a mere $150. If you earn $9,400 while she earns only $150, maybe your incentives aren't aligned after all. Especially when she's the one paying for the ads and doing all the work. Is the agent willing to put out all that extra time, money, and energy for just $150? There's one way to find out. Measure the difference between the sales data for houses that belong to real estate agents themselves and the houses they sold on behalf of clients. Using the data from the sales of those 100,000 Chicago homes and controlling for any number of variables, location, age and quality of the house, aesthetics, and so on, it turns out that a real estate agent keeps her own home on the market an average of 10 days longer and sells it for an extra 3+% or $10,000 on a $300,000 house. When she sells her own house, an agent holds out for the best offer. When she sells yours, she pushes you to take the first decent offer that comes along. Like a stockbroker churning commissions, she wants to make deals and make them fast. Why not? Her share of a better offer, $150, is too puny an incentive to encourage her to do otherwise. Of all the truisms about politics, one is held to be truer than the rest. Money buys elections. Arnold Schwarzenegger, Michael Bloomberg, John Corzine, these are but a few recent dramatic examples of the truism at work. Disregard for a moment the contrary examples of Howard Dean, Steve Forbes, Michael Huffington, and especially Thomas Golisano, who over the course of three gubernatorial elections in New York spent $93 million of his own money and won 4%, 8%, and 14% respectively of the vote. Most people would agree that money has an undue influence on elections and that far too much money is spent on political campaigns. Indeed, election data show it is true that the candidate who spends more money in a campaign usually wins. But is money the cause of the victory? It might seem logical to think so, much as it might have seemed logical that a booming economy in the 1990s helped reduce crime. But just because two things are correlated does not mean that one causes the other. A correlation simply means that a relationship exists between two factors. Let's call them X and Y. But it tells you nothing about the direction of that relationship. It's possible that X causes Y. It's also possible that Y causes X. And it may be that X and Y are both being caused by some other factor, Z. Consider this scenario. Cities with a lot of murders also tend to have a lot of police officers. Let's now look at the police murder correlation in a pair of real cities, Denver and Washington, D.C., which have about the same population. But Washington has nearly three times as many police as Denver, and it also has eight times the number of murders. Unless you have more information, however, it's hard to say what's causing what. Someone who didn't know better might contemplate these figures and conclude that it is all those extra police in Washington who are causing the extra murders. Such wayward thinking, which has a long history, generally provokes a wayward response. Consider the folk tale of the Tsar who learned that the most disease-ridden province in his empire was also the province with the most doctors. His solution? He promptly ordered all the doctors shot dead. Now, returning to the issue of campaign spending. In order to figure out the relationship between money and elections, it helps to consider the incentives at play in campaign finance. Let's say you are the kind of person who might contribute $1,000 to a candidate. Chances are you'll give the money in one of two situations, a close race in which you think the money will influence the outcome, or a campaign in which one candidate is a sure winner and you would like to bask in reflected glory or receive some future in-kind consideration. The one candidate you won't contribute to is a sure loser. Just ask any presidential hopeful who bombs in Iowa and New Hampshire. So front runners and incumbents raise a lot more money than long shots. And what about spending that money? Incumbents and front runners obviously have more cash, but they only spend a lot of it when they stand a legitimate chance of losing. Otherwise, why dip into a war chest that might be more useful later on when a more formidable opponent appears? Now picture two candidates, one intrinsically appealing and the other not so. The appealing candidate raises much more money and wins easily. But was it the money that won him the votes? Or was it his appeal that won the votes and the money? That's a crucial question, but a very hard one to answer. Voter appeal, after all, isn't easy to quantify. How can it be measured? It can't really, except in one special case. The key is to measure a candidate against himself. That is, candidate A today is likely to be similar to candidate A 2 or 4 years hence. The same could be said for candidate B. Now, if only candidate A ran against candidate B in two consecutive elections, but in each case spent different amounts of money, then, with the two candidates' appeal more or less constant, we could measure the impact of the money. As it turns out, the same two candidates do run against each other in consecutive elections all the time. Indeed, in nearly 1,000 U.S. congressional races since 1972. And what did the numbers have to say about such cases? Here's the surprise. The amount of money spent by the candidates hardly matters at all. A winning candidate can cut his spending in half and lose only 1% of the vote. Meanwhile, a losing candidate who doubles his spending can expect to shift the vote in his favor by only that same 1%. What really matters for a political candidate is not how much you spend. What really matters is who you are. The same could be said, and will be said, in Chapter 5 of this book about parents. Some politicians are inherently attractive to voters, and others simply aren't, and no amount of money can do much about it. Messrs. Dean, Forbes, Huffington, and Golisano already know this, of course. And what about the other half of the election truism, that the amount of money spent on campaign finance is obscenely huge? In a typical election period that includes campaigns for the presidency, the Senate, and the House of Representatives, about $1 billion is spent per year, which sounds like a lot of money, unless you care to measure it against something seemingly less important than Democratic elections. It is the same amount, for instance, that Americans spend every year on chewing gum. This isn't a book about the cost of chewing gum versus campaign spending per se, or about disingenuous real estate agents, or the impact of legalized abortion on crime. It will certainly address these scenarios and dozens more, from the art of parenting to the mechanics of cheating, from the inner workings of the Ku Klux Klan to racial discrimination on the weakest link. What this is about is stripping a layer or two from the surface of modern life and seeing what is happening underneath. We will ask a lot of questions, some frivolous and some about life and death issues. The answers may often seem odd, but after the fact also rather obvious. We will seek out these answers in the data, whether those data come in the form of school children's test scores, or New York City's crime statistics, or a crack dealer's financial records. Often, we will take advantage of data that were incidentally left behind, like an airplane's sharp contrail in a high sky. It is well and good to opine or theorize about a subject, as humankind is wont to do, but when moral posturing is replaced by an honest assessment of the data, most subjects actually become even more compelling. Morality, it could be argued, represents the way that people would like the world to work, whereas economics represents how it actually does work. Economics is, above all, a science of measurement. It comprises an extraordinarily powerful and flexible set of tools that can reliably assess a thicket of information to determine the effect of any one factor, or even the whole effect. That's what the economy is, after all, a thicket of information about jobs and real estate and banking and investment. But the tools of economics can be just as easily applied to subjects that are more, well, more interesting. This recording, then, represents a very specific worldview based on a few fundamental ideas. One. Incentives are the cornerstone of modern life, and understanding them, or often ferreting them out, is the key to solving just about any riddle, from violent crime to sports cheating to online dating. Two, the conventional wisdom is often wrong. Crime didn't keep soaring in the 1990s, money alone doesn't win elections, and surprise, drinking 8 glasses of water a day has never actually been shown to do a thing for your health. Conventional wisdom is often shoddily formed and devilishly difficult to overturn, but it can be done. Three, dramatic effects often have distant, even subtle, causes. The answer to a given riddle is not always right in front of you. Norma McCorvey had a far greater impact on crime than did the combined forces of gun control, a strong economy, and innovative police strategies. So did, as we shall see, a man named Oscar Daniil Blandon, a.k.a. the Johnny Appleseed of crack. Four, experts, from criminologists to real estate agents, use their informational advantage to serve their own agenda. However, they can be beat at their own game. And in the face of the internet, their informational advantage is shrinking every day, as evidenced by, among other things, the falling price of coffins and life insurance premiums. Five, knowing what to measure and how to measure it makes a complicated world much less so. If you learn to look at data in the right way, you can explain riddles that otherwise might have seemed impossible, because there is nothing like the sheer power of numbers to scrub away layers of confusion and contradiction. So our aim here is to explore the hidden side of everything. This may occasionally be a frustrating exercise. It may sometimes feel as if we are peering at the world through a straw, or even staring into a funhouse mirror. But the idea is to look at many different scenarios and examine them in a way that have rarely been examined. In some regards, this is a strange concept for a book. Most books put forth a single theme, crisply expressed in a sentence or two, and then tell the entire story of that theme. The history of salt, the fragility of democracy, the use and misuse of punctuation. This one boasts no such unifying theme. We did consider, for about 6 minutes, writing a book that would revolve around a single theme, the theory and practice of applied microeconomics, anyone? But opted instead for a sort of treasure hunt approach. Yes, this approach employs the best analytical tools that economics can offer, but it also allows us to follow whatever freakish curiosities may occur to us. Thus, our invented field of study, freakonomics. The sort of stories we are going to tell are not often covered in Econ 101, but that may not be true forever. Since the science of economics is primarily a set of tools as opposed to a subject matter, then no subject, however offbeat, should be beyond its reach. It is worth remembering that Adam Smith, the founder of classical economics, was first and foremost a philosopher. He strove to be a moralist, and in so doing, became an economist. When he published The Theory of Moral Sentiments in 1759, modern capitalism was just getting underway. Smith was entranced by the sweeping changes wrought by this new force, but it wasn't only the numbers that interested him. It was the human effect, the fact that economic forces were vastly changing the way a person thought and behaved in a given situation. What might lead one person to cheat or steal while another didn't? How would one person's seemingly innocuous choice, good or bad, affect a great number of people down the line? In Smith's era, cause and effect had begun to wildly accelerate. Incentives were magnified tenfold. The gravity and shock of these changes were as overwhelming to the citizens of his time as the gravity and shock of modern life seem to us today. Smith's true subject was the friction between individual desire and societal norms. The economic historian Robert Heilbronner, writing in The Worldly Philosophers, wondered how Smith was able to separate the doings of man, a creature of self-interest, from the greater moral plane in which man operated. Heilbronner wrote, "Smith held that the answer lay in our ability to put ourselves in the position of a third person, an impartial observer, and in this way to form a notion of the objective merits of a case." Consider yourself, then, in the company of a third person, or, if you will, a pair of third people, eager to explore the objective merits of interesting cases. These explorations generally begin with the asking of a simple, unasked question, such as, "What do school teachers and sumo wrestlers have in common?" And so, Chapter 1. What do school teachers and sumo wrestlers have in common? Let's suppose you are the manager of a daycare center. You have a clearly stated policy that children are supposed to be picked up by 4 p.m. But very often parents are late. The result? At day's end, you have some anxious children and at least one teacher who must wait around for the parents to arrive. What to do? A pair of economists who heard of this dilemma, it turned out to be a rather common one, offered a solution. Fine the late parents. Why, after all, should the daycare center take care of these kids for free? The economists decided to test their solution by conducting a study of 10 daycare centers in Haifa, Israel. The study lasted 20 weeks, but the fine was not introduced immediately. For the first 4 weeks, the economists simply kept track of the number of parents who came late. There were, on average, 8 late pickups per week per daycare center. In the 5th week, the fine was enacted. It was announced that any parent arriving more than 10 minutes late would pay $3 per child for each incident. The fee would be added to the parent's monthly bill, which was roughly $380. After the fine was enacted, the number of late pickups promptly went up. Before long, there were 20 late pickups per week, more than double the original average. The incentive had plainly backfired. Economics is, at root, the study of incentives, how people get what they want or need, especially when other people want or need the same thing. Economists love incentives. They love to dream them up and enact them, study them and tinker with them. The typical economist believes the world has not yet invented a problem that he cannot fix if given a free hand to design the proper incentive scheme. His solution may not always be pretty. It may involve coercion or exorbitant penalties or the violation of civil liberties, but the original problem, rest assured, will be fixed. An incentive is a bullet, a lever, a key, an often tiny object with astonishing power to change a situation. We all learn to respond to incentives, negative and positive, from the outset of life. If you toddle over to the hot stove and touch it, you burn a finger. But if you bring home straight A's from school, you get a new bike. If you were spotted picking your nose in class, you get ridiculed. But if you make the basketball team, you move up the social ladder. If you break curfew, you get grounded. But if you ace your SATs, you get to go to a good college. If you flunk out of law school, you have to go to work at your father's insurance company. But if you perform so well that a rival company comes calling, you become a vice president and no longer have to work for your father. If you become so excited about your new vice president job that you drive home at 80 miles an hour, you get pulled over by the police and fined $100. But if you hit your sales projections and collect a year-end bonus, you not only aren't worried about the $100 ticket, but you can also afford to buy that Viking range you've always wanted, and on which your toddler can now burn her own finger. An incentive is simply a means of urging people to do more of a good thing and less of a bad thing. But most incentives don't come about organically. Someone, an economist or a politician or a parent, has to invent them. Your 3-year-old eats all her vegetables for a week? She wins a trip to the toy store. A big steelmaker belches too much smoke into the air? The company is fined for each cubic foot of pollutants over the legal limit. Too many Americans aren't paying their share of income tax? It was the economist Milton Friedman who helped come up with a solution to this one, automatic tax withholding from employees' paychecks. There are three basic flavors of incentive, economic, social, and moral. Very often, a single incentive scheme will include all three varieties. Think about the anti-smoking campaign of recent years. The addition of a $3 per pack sin tax is a strong economic incentive against buying cigarettes. The banning of cigarettes in restaurants and bars is a powerful social incentive. And when the U.S. government asserts that terrorists raise money by selling black market cigarettes, that acts as a rather jarring moral incentive. Some of the most compelling incentives yet invented have been put in place to deter crime. Considering this fact, it might be worthwhile to take a familiar question: why is there so much crime in modern society? And stand it on its head: why isn't there a lot more crime? After all, every one of us regularly passes up opportunities to maim, steal, and defraud. The chance of going to jail, thereby losing your job, your house, and your freedom, all of which are essentially economic penalties, is certainly a strong incentive. But when it comes to crime, people also respond to moral incentives. They don't want to do something they consider wrong. And social incentives. They don't want to be seen by others as doing something wrong. For certain types of misbehavior, social incentives are terribly powerful. In an echo of Hester Prynne's Scarlet Letter, many American cities now fight prostitution with a shaming offensive, posting pictures of convicted Johns and prostitutes on websites or on local access television. Which is a more horrifying deterrent, a $500 fine for soliciting a prostitute, or the thought of your friends and family ogling you on www.hookersandjohns.com? So, through a complicated, haphazard, and constantly readjusted web of economic, social, and moral incentives, modern society does its best to militate against crime. Some people would argue that we don't do a very good job, but taking the long view, that's clearly not true. Consider the historical trend in homicide, not including wars, which is both the most reliably measured crime and the best barometer of a society's overall crime rate. These statistics, compiled by the criminologist Manuel Eisner, track the historical homicide levels in five European regions, and they show that in every region, homicides have fallen dramatically over the centuries. The steep decline of these numbers suggests that, for one of the gravest human concerns, getting murdered, the incentives that we collectively cook up are working better and better. So, what was wrong with the incentive at the Israeli daycare centers? You have probably already guessed that the $3 fine was simply too small. For that price, a parent with one child could afford to be late every day and only pay an extra $60 each month, just 1/6 of the base fee. As babysitting goes, that's pretty cheap. What if the fine had been set at $100 instead of $3? That would have likely put an end to the late pickups, though it would have also engendered plenty of ill will. Any incentive is inherently a trade-off. The trick is to balance the extremes. But there was another problem with the daycare center fine. It substituted an economic incentive, the $3 penalty, for a moral incentive, the guilt that parents were supposed to feel when they came late. So for just a few dollars each day, parents could buy off their guilt. Furthermore, the small size of the fine sent a signal to the parents that late pickups weren't such a big problem. If the daycare center suffers only $3 worth of pain for each late pickup, why bother to cut short my tennis game? Indeed, when the economists eliminated the $3 fine in the 17th week of their study, the number of late arriving parents didn't change. Now they could arrive late, pay no fine, and feel no guilt. Such is the strange and powerful nature of incentives. A slight tweak can produce drastic and often unforeseen results. Thomas Jefferson noted this while reflecting on the tiny incentive that led to the Boston Tea Party and, in turn, the American Revolution. He said, "So inscrutable is the arrangement of causes and consequences in this world that a two-penny duty on tea unjustly imposed in a sequestered part of it changes the conditions of all its inhabitants." In the 1970s, researchers conducted a study that, like the Israeli daycare study, pitted a moral incentive against an economic incentive. In this case, they wanted to learn about the motivation behind blood donations. Their discovery? When people are given a small stipend for donating blood, rather than simply being praised for their altruism, they tend to donate less blood. The stipend turned a noble act of charity into a painful way to make a few dollars, and it wasn't worth it. But what if the blood donors had been offered an incentive of $50, or $500, or $5,000? Surely the number of donors would have changed dramatically. But something else would have changed dramatically as well, for every incentive has its dark side. If a pint of blood were suddenly worth $5,000, you can be sure that plenty of people would take note. They might literally steal blood at knife point. They might pass off pig blood as their own. They might circumvent donation limits by using fake IDs. Whatever the incentive, whatever the situation, dishonest people will try to gain an advantage by whatever means necessary. Or, as W.C. Fields once said, a thing worth having is a thing worth cheating for. To catch a cheater, it helps to think like one. If you were willing to erase your students' wrong answers and fill in correct ones, you probably wouldn't want to change too many wrong answers. That would clearly be a tip-off. You probably wouldn't even want to change answers on every student's test. Another tip-off. Nor, in all likelihood, would you have enough time, because the answer sheets are turned in soon after the test is over. So what you might do is select a string of 8 or 10 consecutive answers and fill in the correct answers for maybe 1/2 or 2/3 of your students. You could easily memorize a short pattern of correct answers, and it would be a lot faster to erase and change that pattern than to go through each student's answer sheet individually. You might even think to focus your activity toward the end of the test, where the questions tend to be harder than the earlier questions. In that way, you'd be most likely to substitute correct answers for wrong ones. If economics is a science primarily concerned with incentives, it is also, fortunately, a a science with statistical tools to measure how people respond to those incentives. All you need are some data. In this case, the Chicago Public School System obliged. It made available a database of the test answers for every CPS student from third grade through seventh grade from 1993 to 2000. This amounts to roughly 30,000 students per grade per year, more than 700,000 sets of answers, and nearly 100 million individual answers. The data, organized by classroom, included each student's question-by-question answer strings for reading and math tests. The actual paper answer sheets were not included. They were habitually shredded soon after a test. The data also included some information about each teacher and demographic information for every student, as well as his or her past and future test scores, which would prove a key element in detecting the teacher cheating. Now it was time to construct an algorithm that could tease some conclusions from this massive data. What might a cheating teacher's classroom look like? The first thing to search for would be unusual answer patterns in a given classroom. Blocks of identical answers, for instance, especially among the harder questions. If 10 very bright students, as indicated by their past and future test scores, gave correct answers to the exam's first 5 questions, which are typically the easiest ones, such an identical block shouldn't be considered suspicious. But if 10 poor students gave correct answers to the last 5 questions on the exam, the hardest ones, that's worth looking into. Another red flag would be a strange pattern within any one student's exam, such as getting the hard questions right while missing the easy ones, especially when measured against the thousands of students in other classrooms who scored similarly on the same test. Furthermore, the algorithm would seek out a classroom full of students who performed far better than their past scores would have predicted, and who then went on to score significantly lower the following year. A dramatic 1-year spike in test scores might initially be attributed to a good teacher, but with a dramatic fall to follow, there's a strong likelihood that the spike was brought about by artificial means. In the print version of this book, you can see the answer strings from the students in 2 sixth grade Chicago classrooms who took the identical math test. Each horizontal row represents one student's answers. The letter A, B, C, or D indicates a correct answer. A number indicates a wrong answer, with 1 corresponding to A, 2 corresponding to B, and so on. A 0 represents an answer that was left blank. One of these classrooms almost certainly had a cheating teacher, and the other did not. Once the cheating algorithm is applied to those 2 classrooms, a clear pattern emerges. In classroom A, there is a very suspicious answer string. In the book, it's rendered in bold, that reads D, A, D, B, C, B in 15 out of the 22 students' answers. Did 15 out of 22 students somehow manage to reel off the same 6 consecutive correct answers all by themselves? There are at least 4 reasons this is unlikely. 1. Those questions came near the end of the test and were harder than the earlier questions. 2. These were mainly subpar students to begin with, few of whom got 6 consecutive right answers elsewhere on the test, making it all the more unlikely they would get right the same 6 hard questions. 3. Up to this point in the test, the 15 students' answers were virtually uncorrelated. 4. 3 of the students left at least 1 answer blank before the suspicious string, and then ended the test with another string of blanks. This suggests that a long, unbroken string of blank answers was broken not by the student, but by the teacher. There is another oddity about the suspicious answer string. On 9 of the 15 tests, the 6 correct answers are preceded by another identical string, 3A12, which includes 3 of 4 incorrect answers. And on all 15 tests, the 6 correct answers are followed by the same incorrect answer, a 4. Why on earth would a cheating teacher go to the trouble of erasing a student's test sheet and then fill in the wrong answer? Perhaps she is merely being strategic. In case she is caught and hauled into the principal's office, she could point to the wrong answers as proof that she didn't cheat. Or perhaps, and this is a less charitable but just as likely answer, she doesn't know the right answers herself. With standardized tests, the teacher is typically not given an answer key. If this is the case, then we have a pretty good clue as to why her students are in need of inflated grades in the first place. They have a bad teacher. Another indication of teacher cheating in Classroom A is the class's overall performance. As sixth graders who were taking the test in the eighth month of the academic year, these students needed to achieve an average score of 6.8 to be considered up to speed. Fifth graders taking the test in the eighth month of the year needed to score 5.8, seventh graders 7.8, and so on. The students in Classroom A averaged 5.8 on their sixth grade tests, which is a full grade level below where they should be. So plainly, these are poor students. A year earlier, however, these students did even worse. They averaged just 4.1 on their fifth grade tests. Instead of improving by one full point between fifth and sixth grade, as would be expected, they improved by 1.7 points, nearly two grades worth. But this miraculous improvement was short-lived. When these sixth grade students reached seventh grade, they averaged 5.5, more than two grade levels below standard and even worse than they did in sixth grade. The three-year scores from Classroom B, meanwhile, are also poor, but at least indicate an honest effort, 4.2, and then 5.1, and then 6.0. So an entire roomful of children in Classroom A suddenly got very smart one year and very dim the next, or, more likely, their sixth grade teacher worked some magic with a number two pencil. There are two noteworthy points to be made about the children in Classroom A, tangential to the cheating itself. The first is that they are obviously in terrible academic shape, which makes them the very children whom high-stakes testing is promoted as helping the most. The second point is that these students were in for a terrible shock once they reached the seventh grade. All they knew is that they had been successfully promoted due to their test scores. No child left behind, indeed. They weren't the ones who artificially jacked up their scores. They probably expected to do great in the seventh grade, and then they failed miserably. This may be the cruelest twist yet in high-stakes testing. A cheating teacher may tell herself that she is helping her students, but the fact is that she would appear far more concerned with helping herself. An analysis of the entire Chicago data reveals evidence of teacher cheating in some 200 classrooms per year, roughly 5% of the total. This is a conservative estimate since the algorithm was able to identify only the most egregious form of cheating, in which teachers systematically change students' answers, and not the many subtler ways a teacher might cheat. In a recent study among North Carolina school teachers, some 35% of the respondents said they had witnessed their colleagues cheating in some fashion, whether by giving students extra time, suggesting answers, or manually changing students' answers. What are the characteristics of a cheating teacher? The Chicago data show that male and female teachers are about equally prone to cheating. A cheating teacher tends to be younger and less qualified than average. She is also more likely to cheat after her incentives change. Because the Chicago data ran from 1993 to 2000, it bracketed the introduction of high-stakes testing in 1996. Sure enough, there was a pronounced spike in cheating in 1996. Nor was the cheating random. It was the teachers in the lowest scoring classrooms, the worst teachers in the school, that is, who were most likely to cheat. It should also be noted that the $25,000 bonus for California teachers was eventually revoked, in part because of suspicions that too much of the money was going to cheaters. Not every result of the Chicago cheating analysis was so dour. In addition to detecting cheaters, the algorithm could also identify the best teachers in the school system. A good teacher's impact was nearly as distinctive as a cheater's. Instead of getting random answers correct, her students would show real improvement on the easier types of questions they had previously missed, an indication of actual learning, and a good teacher's students carried over all their gains into the next grade. Most academic analyses of this sort tend to languish unread on a dusty library shelf. But in early 2002, the new CEO of the Chicago Public Schools, Arne Duncan, contacted the study's authors. He didn't want to protest or hush up their findings. Rather, he wanted to make sure that the teachers identified by the algorithm as cheaters were truly cheating and then do something about it. Duncan was an unlikely candidate to hold such a powerful job. He was only 36 when appointed, a one-